You're listening to the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirk Wood Bromley.
All right, so this episode of the Inverse Theater Podcast involves a discussion between me and John Gideon Grossman, otherwise known as Gideon. Gideon is the second composer I worked with after Jessica Graceswing died of cancer in 2003. And we did quite a few projects together, the biggest ones being The Bangers Flopera, Unentitled, Me, and Cicatrix Adaptitude. And this podcast was something I scheduled to get with Gideon after not having chatted with him in quite a long time. Our collaboration kind of came to an end when I stopped doing live plays in 2012. We did keep working on music together, and he is featured on quite a few songs by the Goodhart. But theatrically, we stopped working together. And I always felt, you know, it was a tragedy that the work we did was not available to the public. Certainly those people who saw the plays live had heard the music, but I always wish that the demos and the live recordings and all the songs could be taken off his computer and shared with the world. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to get him on the podcast, and I'm going to chat with him, and we're going to kind of reconnect, and I'm going to revitalize his memory of how awesome it is to work with me and to work together. And that fortunately worked out. So as a result of this podcast, as a result of this discussion, the music that Gideon and I made together is going to see the light of day or sound the hum of the world. And that is a super positive outcome. So there's a lot in here, and I express most of my feelings in the interview, so I'm just going to move on to that. John Gideon Grossman, composer and collaborator of mine for many years. Here he is. John Gideon Grossman, I guess that is that what I'm going to call you? John Gideon Gross. That's your full name, right?
Yeah.
I've always called you Gideon. Everybody calls you Gideon.
Yeah, so Gideon it shall be.
Gideon, yeah. Great. Well, hey, Gideon. It's been a while since I've seen you.
Yeah.
Both of us have been through a lot, we're going to try to touch on what we can today. It took us like weeks and months.
Yeah.
We were supposed to do this on your birthday, and that fell through. I think I was in Los Angeles. I'm sorry about that. Happy birthday.
Oh, thanks.
But I'm glad we did finally get down to it. I think some of the hardships were that you and I are both, you're going through between New York City and your upstate place.
Yeah.
I'm going between here and there and my country place.
Yeah.
So we're both country folk now, but not full time. So.
Right.
So we're here. So thank you. It's great to have you.
Thanks.
I'm really excited about this. You know, as I mentioned in the intro, you were a critical major creative team member of mine and with Inverse for many years.
Yeah.
And so I think to start, I'd like to start by just asking you how you first became aware of Bromley Theater, Inverse Theater, whatever. Like, what was your introduction? How did you initially get involved?
I should start by saying it's because it's been so long, it's weird to jump right into it. So
it's fine.
I hope it stays
weird.
Well, no, according to what you were saying, that if all the, you know, keeps it fresh and mm-hmm. so,
But you know, we're going to reminisce, you know what I mean? I think it's the first time I have you on. There's a lot for you and I to say conceptually, creatively.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot that
I think we can talk about.
What
I've mostly found with people right out of the gate is just try to kind of get a little bit of the story.
Right.
Like,
right.
Meaning like, how'd you get involved?
Right, right,
what kind of show, what shows did you work on? So I think we'll move chronologically through the shows you worked on.
That's great. I wrote stuff down, you know, if that's easier. So,
whatever you want to do, but I'd love to hear about like, I think it was at the Verse Circus, but I'd like to hear, I'd like to hear what you think of as your first introduction. Well, the Verse Circus wasn't the first time you saw a Bromley play, but it was your introduction to the group.
Yeah.
So there's different levels of introduction. So why don't you just go into that?
Yeah, I remember early on going to see Verse Circus, and I don't remember if that was after or before I saw my first show, which was Lost Labor's Loved at Nada.
How did you come to that?
Because I did a show that Hank Wagner was in. I sat in on some percussion stuff, and then he and I hooked up, and he invited me to one or both of those.
So you worked as a percussionist on a show that Hank was doing?
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah. And then
Hank was in Lost Labor's Love.
Yeah, he was in Inverse, and he invited me.
Okay, and so he invited you to come see the show.
Yeah, actually, as far as the Verse Circus goes, I actually distinctly remember, and I don't know if I had officially met you or not, but I may have. But Hank and I were like having coffee somewhere, and you walked in. And I had my friend's bass on my back in like a case. And I didn't play bass at the time. And you came in and Hank said something like, I don't know, you remember getting something. And you were like, yeah. You gonna play something tonight? You know? And I was like, no. There was so much to explain, but you were in a rush. But I remember that. Distinctly,
sure. No, I remember you as my impression was like you were hard to get. Like you were like not jumping on stage.
Oh,
you were not going to be a musician.
That's
you were
true.
Not going to be a performer. You were not interested in sharing anything. It was really it was really closed. There was closed.
Yeah, I was not. I was not in that. I was not in the place I was in later when we eventually.
Yeah. You're not a short man, but I remember you being like maybe 3 feet off the ground. Like you just had this way of like slumping and slithering around.
That's interesting. Well, I think I was sitting at that time, so that might have had something to do with it. But I hear you what you're saying.
We were all slouchers.
No. I was
like
a reticent.
The 90s, you know what I mean?
I was a reticent
person. Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, it was just.
And now you're a raging extrovert.
It was interesting that I was going through that process before you and I started working together. Obviously, not knowing that we would work together, but there was a period of time where I was slowly, incrementally coming out of my shell in terms of. Writing and giving a shit if anybody heard it or not. I was just writing to write and to get it out of me. And the idea of other people hearing it or public performance, it was just not even a dream.
Right. Okay,
so, I wasn't craving it certainly, and I never even thought of
it.
So
it's obviously a slow burn because I mean, Lost Labor's Loved was like 1998. And Verse Circus wasn't, we probably didn't meet at Verse Circus till 3, 4, 5 years later.
Yeah.
So really quickly, like when you saw Lost Labor's Loved, what'd you think? Did you keep coming to shows?
Did
you keep Inverse on your radar or what?
I did. I was, I flipped out at that performance. I think I wrote something to Martin Denton a couple of weeks ago. he was asking some question, and I remember one of the things I wrote to him was how it's just such a magical place. I mean, it was a hole in the wall, but it's this magical place, I thought. And I just thought, how, what an odd space for, you know, a play to go on. And there's that scene where they run out into the street, up the stairs and onto the street. And I just, it was just so fucking brave. And I just thought, my God, like, this is going on. This is happening. This is even before, or separate from the verse part, meaning the actual text, just the electricity.
Nada was a really fun space.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I was blown away, and I did want to follow up, and I think I saw Griffin Hunter next.
Yes, probably.
And also fantastic. Just the yeah, I guess there's no way to separate the fact that it's in verse with the balls of whatever everybody was doing, because it's built in, and but there is a degree of constant courage there, I guess. But
you'd had some experience like being a musician for theater, is that right?
Yeah, I was originally a drummer, and I started.
Oh, right, you were doing like the tour of Tommy and shit like that, weren't you?
Not that one, but other tours and
and
a bunch of regional stuff and
right. Right.
And
so was this inverse stuff definitely like kind of the most like downtown small
absolutely
funky shit you'd seen?
Absolutely. I was playing. I mean, I'd seen a lot of theater and but mostly musicals, and most of the musicals historically have not been, you know, daring or anything like that. So it was really middle of the road stuff and but I was a big Sondheim fan and so I had seen those but yes, I was not prepared for that, for the amount of shit that was going on in that play on all levels, the acting, the writing, the space, the music. I remember, you know how there are people have these visceral internal like olfactory memories or something like that. I have an auditory memory still of the very first moment that play started. And I think it was a Miles Davis tune being played as Josh walked out, maybe, or as someone walked out. And I was immediately, what the fuck is happening here? Like,
was a really great sound designer. He's a huge music aficionado, and he filled his plays with great tunes.
Yeah.
Now, I might not launch from this point forward. I might go back a little bit just in order to try to create the parentheses.
Yeah.
What's the first thing you and I worked on together?
I guess there's an official answer and an unofficial answer. The word together being the operative part.
Yeah, and I mean obviously we've done stuff like music and stuff, but like,
yeah, official
first, like play you worked on.
Well, officially it was, see, I don't know how to answer that. Officially I would say it was Bangor's Flopera, but we had I had written a bunch of songs for Darwin. But we weren't working together. We didn't really work together ever really in the Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Was Darwin before?
Darwin was before. I first whatever term you want to use, co-musical directed Grace Notes.
And
it was during that you were in pre-production for Darwin. And Josh came over and asked me if I would be the sort of musical person for Darwin, and that there were
you wrote songs.
I wrote Sims songs.
Oh, like, yeah, okay.
Like four of those, and okay. And I played one of the like the young soldier and drums, and the drums for the. And so, and that's yeah, it. So I was writing to your lyrics then, but we didn't speak about it. And then,
said, I don't even remember.
Yeah.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah. And you heard them and you said, I just said you're writing some really good stuff for the show. I did write the two songs that Mark Hallman wrote, ended up writing, but they weren't in it, but I was writing them anyway because they were beautiful lyrics and I wanted
that's them. Right. Mark Hallman wrote two songs for Darwin so we could put his name on the poster.
Exactly. It was a very political
move. It was totally a commercial, political, totally, sexual, totally, everything. Totally. Because Mark Hallman is the composer of Urinetown, right, which at that time and still is.
Yeah, huge.
It was a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so it's interesting that you say grace notes. I'm reminded that there's that Hamlet line where the meats of the funeral table did grace the table of the wedding or something, you know, because grace notes was, because I think for me, it's important to point out that like, I had a composer for a number of years, Jessica Grace Wing. I've talked about her with other people and she died in 2003. And, right before Lost occurred. And then as an event, an in memoriam event, we did something called Grace Notes. Her middle name is Grace. And we performed kind of all the songs she'd ever written for our plays, as a big company, a bunch of people, all kinds of things. And this was your entree, to come in. So I kind of found my second wife at the funeral of my first, which you know is not unlike me, perhaps. But were you like? I seem to remember you had even maybe a role in Grace Notes. You're right; that would be kind of the first time you stepped in. Like you had a lot of sound equipment. You had a ton of knowledge about just performance and audio, and did you participate in helping Grace Notes? Because that's something that not a lot of people have talked about. And Grace Notes was an amazing event. Were you involved in Grace Notes, like setting it up?
Yeah, I was. Hank was the musical director, and he asked me to be co-musical director for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. I was playing drums in the band, and I was doing some sampling and some arranging. And it actually, when you were saying that, I remember that as actually wasn't the very first one. I think the very first involvement was a production of Midnight Brainwash Revival that Josh was directing, and Hank asked me to put a band together for that.
Was this the one at like the Theatorium or something like down the Lower East Side, like sketchy, cold, dusty space?
No, it was.
Remember where it was?
No, it was. I do. It was in a cold office building. It was a very pristine little room, which was not a theater. It was like a room, and they put chairs in it.
I don't even remember.
Yeah,
that.
It was one of five Brainwash productions.
That's right. That's right.
But
it must have literally been one of those like, there's empty office space available to artists in Manhattan.
It was fantastic. It was so a testament to the Inverse crew.
Yeah,
it was just fantastic.
And you put a band together?
I put a band together for the you know, the underscore stuff and the Hank was in it and he couldn't play in it. So I did that. It was Moberg was in it and and
Al Bendit.
Al Bendit walked in at the end as the father. That was his only.
Right.
And I hadn't seen the play before, and I saw it, and I flipped the fuck out. But yeah, Moberg was in it, and Jenny Hannigan,
Josh, obviously,
back then, and. Yeah, Josh.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And
was Matt Mare in it that time?
No, I don't think Matt Mare was in that one. He was in.
Yeah.
Griffin when I saw it, certainly. And Lost Labor's Love.
Yeah.
Oh, he was so fucking funny in that. I couldn't believe.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't believe how funny he was.
I'm very happy that you. I think you're the only person I know whose entree to my writing was Lost Labor's Loved. Everybody's always like, oh, I saw this, I saw that, I saw that. And I've never ran in anybody who's like, I saw Lost Labor's Loved and I just loved it. So that's very validating for me.
Yeah.
So thank you. You're off to a really, really good start.
Good.
Now, I think what I want to say is, we have this production of Grace of Midnight Brainwash Revival in a cold office where you do some underscoring,
right.
You get a band together.
Right.
These are hints of what's to come.
Correct.
And then Grace Notes, you were on stage playing drums. I'm sure you worked with Hank intimately to get the whole audio set up. Again, hints of things to come. You write a few tunes.
Yeah.
As in a sense, the B-list composer
for
Darwin, because
Mark
Holman, Mark Holman does two songs, and of course makes him the composer of the show. Even though you probably wrote three times the songs.
Well, more songs, and those songs were much more important in the scope of the play. They were all about Darwin, and they were very important lyrically, especially.
Super.
Holman
of
wrote,
course,
you know, "Rub a Dub Dub," we're scrubbing the deck. which I also wrote, but still, that's
right. Okay. But you know, I think you understand.
So
then we come to, so that's all good. I mean, we can maybe talk more intimately about your artistic experience with those things, but I want to really jump was the next was, which was the, really the first full blown collaboration.
Yeah.
So let me say quickly. So basically, before I think I even knew you, Chris Anderson, who founded and has run Gorilla Rep Theater for many, many, many years, and who I saw in the 90s do Midsummer Night's Dream a bunch of times in Washington Square Park, Theater in the Park, and really blew my mind the way maybe Lost Labor's Dubs did for you, and just in the sense of like seeing Shakespeare. I'd never seen Shakespeare in the Park.
Yeah.
I mean, really in the park, like people just not Shakespeare in the park,
Delacorte,
but
on the grass.
Right. Shakespeare, like in the ghetto park,
right
on the grass. Everybody's sitting on the grass, people running around on
barbecues,
on playgrounds.
And
with like, you know, the whole like, here comes the homeless crackhead who's going to interrupt the production.
Right.
And then the cast has like all these techniques to like involve the guy
include,
in the play and diffuse, deploy,
Improv.
And so that blew my mind. And so I went right after Chris Anderson. I was like, man, I'm writing verse plays. You're doing Shakespeare. I'm going to change the English language. I'm going to write American verse plays. You got to work with me.
Yeah.
And so he came up with this idea that I would write a beggar's opera.
Mm.
And so I wrote really quick. It really isn't a Bromley play. It was like it's like Bromley light. It was like maybe an hour.
Yeah.
I wrote an update of the beggar's opera by John Gay, classic American play, Mac the Knife, Mr. Peachum, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And Chris Anderson did that. He did it like some theater down in Soho. He did it at like Grand Central.
What you
he
had written,
like
how?
Yeah, like that play happened.
Oh, okay.
Like Mark Greenfield was in it.
That.
And it was fun. It was only like an hour. It was just like comedy.
Yeah.
It was like a comedy. It's like an hour long comedy sketch, but it had music.
Yeah.
Like that Chris Sanderson and his friend Chris Barron wrote.
Oh right.
Which Chris Barron is the lead singer of the Spin Doctors, which segued into me writing Faust for Chris Barron. But that's another story.
Right.
Anyhow, I'd written the Beggar's Opera. for Chris Anderson. But like I said, it was a trite effort. It was a brief expostulation of my creative imagination. And Jessica Wing died and lost the musical, had, it got a lot of attention. Mm. A lot of people saw it. And I thought, oh, this musical thing is pretty cool, but my composer is dead and what am I going to do? And so it always had intrigued me to think like, maybe I can write, like, maybe I'll write the Beggar's Opera and I'll just really like make it a real Bromley play and make it a real show. Right. Because like I said, the thing with Chris was, it was brief and it was okay. It was funny. But it was light.
Yeah.
And so I remember, what I remember is, so what I did was I took that play, which again was like maybe an hour, and I made it about 2 hours. I added songs, I redid, I ramped it up, and I remember thinking, and it must have been the Darwin work you did, because I was like, oh, maybe Gideon can write songs.
Yeah.
And so I sent you the play, and I said, the song lyrics are in italics, you'll see them there, and I'd love to hear what you can do. If you're interested in, kind of auditioning. And in fact, I don't know if you know this, but I did the same thing in Backstage and I received probably 12, 14 submissions of people basically saying Inverse Theater is hiring a composer for its new musical. And I got some nice stuff. I got standard musical theater fare.
Yeah. I actually have a bunch of those.
Oh, okay, good. You have those. Yeah, great. Yeah. Someday that'll be interesting to listen to.
Yeah, I knew that you were doing that. And
then I get yours. Yeah. And then I get yours.
Yeah.
And here is Fuck God.
Yeah.
I know that was in the mix. I think you sent me like three.
Yeah.
You know, they were demo. They were
demos.
Ostensibly demos.
Yeah. Who made the kids?
But they
these
but
days?
They sounded they sent the kids these days, right. But they sounded like they were Metallica, like they were produced.
Right.
They were super, and you were singing.
Right.
And I heard them, and I fell out of my chair.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Because there was this thing at the time, which was rock music, which I know both you and I have listened to, and theater shall never meet, never the twain. Shall meet.
Right, not real
rock. Of course,
rock.
Not real rock. Like, there's something that, like, theater is where rock goes to die.
Right.
You know, like, it or goes there neutered. All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I think before that I had seen Hedwig, and I was like, okay, I'm not sure rock died there.
Totally.
There's something pretty great there.
Yeah, that
but that's, and then, and I don't remember if this was before Beggars Flopra, then you and I saw The Rising Fall of the Falling Risen, or the Falling Rise of the Rising Fallen, right? And I was like, okay, now that's
rock
is
and roll.
Not rock dying in the theater. Yeah. That is rock living even greater. This is this is Banana Bag and Bodice's show. I think it's The Fallen Rise of the Rising Fallen.
Yeah.
They by the way, they recorded that whole show in the studio.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say, as much as I love those guys, the studio versions don't hit
not at all.
What they did on stage.
Not at all. Not at all.
And so I was like,
you're playing on an oil rig.
When I got your demos,
that's right,
a band on an oil rig. And what's his name? Peter Bloomquist, who is now a major,
No. The audio.
Oh, you can hear. You can hear me, right? Okay, great.
I can.
Okay, that's fine.
Repeat what you just said.
Peter Bloomquist was the lead.
Yeah.
And he was like, it was like watching Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And anyhow, let's not go into that. Banana Bag and Bodice is a great theater company.
Yeah.
But when you sent me those demos, I said, holy cow, rock and roll is dead again. It gets alive and it's happening.
Yeah.
It's like fucking rising, fallen, or the falling risen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
bam.
Yeah.
And immediately I was like, we're doing this musical. So we dove in and we made The Bangers Flopra.
Yeah.
And we got a director. His name was Ben Yalom. I had seen his production of Midnight Brainwash Revival in San Francisco. Yeah. It was fantastic. It was killer. I mean, it was so good. People were like falling out of their chairs into the aisle. It was so funny. We got Ben Yalom to come direct, and we did the real thing, didn't we? I mean, yeah. We auditioned citywide,
yeah.
all through New York City.
Yeah.
We were in the Fringe Festival and we were in the New York Musical Theater Festival,
right.
I believe NYMF,
yeah,
NYMF,
right.
The very first year,
right.
And we did the Bangers Flop Room.
Yeah.
And you wrote the music.
Yeah.
And you assembled the band. Yeah. And I think you played in the band. You were the drummer, right?
At times, yes.
Okay. And it was, in my view,
yeah.
Just the greatest damn thing ever.
Yeah.
I just absolutely adored it. The cast was unbelievable.
Yeah.
One legend after another.
Yeah.
The music was, and I've always said that, I don't know if you know this, but I've always said, it was just absolutely perfect. The music was absolutely perfect. And the show was just gross and,
yeah.
And you Lude. Know, the Beggar's Opera, you know, I'll say, you know, is about the thieves and the prostitutes and the scumbags of London,
yeah.
in the dark days of London, you know, 17, whatever. And so my goal was to just make the Bangers Flopera as gross and guttery,
yeah.
And sewery and repulsive as I think the Beggar's Opera was for its day.
Right.
I mean, it was a radical play of its time. You know what I mean? It's just like,
right.
to depict these people with the language. And so I
right.
tried, and so I went hard, as you know.
You had to update it, first of all, because it wouldn't have been.
That's right. It would have been catty.
It would have been like a Baroque, yeah. String quartet or something.
Exactly. And so we did it. So tell me about the Bangers Flop, working on the Bangers Flop, what you did, what it was like.
Yeah.
Tell me.
I guess there's no better place to share all these stories and memories, even things that neither you and I know either that happened or that were in our own thoughts. And so the first thing I remember was Hank had asked, this was a year before I made those demos. I was riding in the car with Hank and he said that you were writing some rock show. And what I thought about that, might I wanna, this is just a year before, and this goes back to my earlier mention of the incremental personal growth at the time. And my initial reaction was just absolutely not. Like, I'm not ready to do that, you know. And I don't know if he was considering writing stuff or if you were considering, but it was absolutely no. And then I don't remember the location. You know, it might have been Grace Notes, actually, now that I think about it. I remember thinking, also to your point about the sort of dovetailing between Jessica and I remember thinking during Grace Notes that you and I would be working together, that I would be writing the music for that show. And I didn't know anything about it yet, but I just had this feeling, a deep feeling of, I don't know what word you want to use, kismet or some kind of something that comes from a place other than our normal waking place. And it was just a feeling, and I just knew that it would happen. I was just sort of waiting to see how it would happen. And then I have a slightly different memory of how it came about, but we had done Darwin, and you had liked the songs, and you wrote me an email saying, hey, I'm writing this show, and I was wondering if, like you said, well, if you'd be interested and take a crack at it. And you sent me, you didn't send me the script, you sent me three sets of lyrics. Mm. And you said, I'm going away for a couple weeks, but maybe if you want to take a crack at it, and when I come back, I'll give them a listen. I think you might have mentioned you sending out feelers to other people. And I was like, yeah, sure. But I think I didn't concretely think it, but it was more of, like I said, just watching it unfold rather than, oh, that's interesting. Do you know what I mean? I knew that you were writing this, and I was just sort of waiting for it to unfold. So I was like, yeah, absolutely. I'd love to take a crack at it. And I wrote the songs, and I recorded them in like a weekend, I think. And
you played the drums and the bass and the guitars and the pianos, yeah, and you sang and you did harmonies. I mean, you did everything. These were not demos. You created full pieces.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think for most people, certainly like some of the demos that were sent to you, with like some old 1980s drum machine, something like that.
On a Casio, yeah.
Yeah,
Casio.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but I don't do that. I don't, it's just not what I do.
No, obviously not.
And I had just gotten this like free bare version of Pro Tools the first time. And I was really diving in, and I had been a drummer and I'd been a piano player. So I had that under my belt, and I had a bass, and I didn't have an electric guitar, believe it or not. And I didn't really play electric guitar before this moment. I had an acoustic guitar that I ran through an effects pedal.
Yeah.
So I mic'd it, and I ran it through it to get the electric guitar sound, because at least two of those songs had, you know, electric guitar. Who made the kids these days and want to maybe fuck that? So I was simultaneously teaching myself to play a particular kind of guitar because I didn't know how to actually play, and learning Pro Tools at the same time. So I was going all out and using it as sort of a – but I had been working for months and months making recordings just for that moment so that I could do it in a weekend. So I wrote the tunes, and it was a blast, and I was a little nervous, I guess, but not tremendously nervous. Again, I saw it as just
you felt you had the job. You kind of knew you had the job.
Cosmically speaking, I didn't. The proof that it was,
well, you were the man for the the man for the job. It's just a question of whether could you manifest that manliness. Yeah.
Yes, and also it's not my style to be that sort of. To have that kind of hubris, or, you know, I could feel it, and I kept it to myself, and I just wanted to see, meaning I would only find out that I was the man for the job after finding out that I was the man for the job.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that. And so there was a good deal of healthy, you know, nervousness before. And, and then I get an email from you, and the title of the email, also, it was a couple of weeks, and I sent it, so there's all that waiting time, and I was like, oh, geez.
Yeah, well, I did that on purpose.
Oh, just to kind of give yourself some time?
I don't know. Yeah.
So I get an email from you, and the title, the subject of the email, before I open it, is something to the effect of, who the fuck do you think you are sending me that shit? Five explanation points. And, you know... before reading the text, that could go either way. I've really angered this person, and he's really upset, and I'm curious to find out why. And then the first line of the email is, "Will you marry me in the artistic world?" And I was like, "Phew, okay." So not angry, happy, good.
Yeah.
All right. So that's a good sign. He liked it.
Right.
Great. I could have done without the initial shock, but it made up for it. and I got a real chuckle out of that. And I was like, yes, I will marry you in the artistic world.
and you did. And that was the first show that we did together, and the first of many yeah. things we did together.
Yeah.
But that was a full dive.
Yeah.
That was a full that was a full marriage.
Yeah.
That was a full year of our life.
Yeah.
And that was a full experience because, you know, that it was a big cast. You know, it was a full musical. This was a musical.
Oh, yeah.
This musical.
Hold on. 25
17,
songs.
Yeah, 25 songs, 17 people.
Yeah.
Made, you know, I don't know how. It was one of those things. I don't know how we even did it with
either.
The resources we had.
I don't either.
And, you know, so I remember, you know, and I remember, you know, you wrote all the tunes. They were all just unbelievable. I think there was like, it was just a, it was like a mix of like Pink Floyd.
Oh yeah.
And Sondheim. And,
it was
know,
everything
the
because
the
there
Stooges.
Was, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
My job being to serve whatever the play is, the play had all those elements in it. Certainly.
That's what you've always just been unparalleled at, has been like looking at whatever lyrics I write as a part of the play and getting the tone and creating a unique vibe and sound for those lyrics that, cause you know, like turn it on, turn it on. Is that the, you know, like, or We Are Sad or, you know, just the, what, Give Me My Mackie? Is that, I mean, that just every song had its own mood and its own, sometimes it was just like an acoustic anthem that just like rips your heart out. Yeah. And sometimes it's just like, I don't think I ever once said to you, I think this song should have this tone, this energy, this message in the plot. You just got it. You're very unbelievably skilled at just reading the lyrics and saying, okay. And you always were careful to read the play to figure out where it's landing in the arc and the story, and to give lots of colors and different styles, emotional styles, so that it really creates, an up and down and a back and forth and a roller, that kind of a dramatic, you know, I mean, it goes without saying, it's just really amazing. And so, you know, I just remember like the musicians were just like, the people you brought in were just like crazy good. Mm. And I think we paid them $100.
Yeah, something like that.
But so basically like we dove into the Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And because I'd done pretty well on the Fringe Festival a couple of times, they gave us, I think it was like, it was the Bowery Ballroom or something.
Oh, it was the Bleecker Theater. I can't believe I'm blanking. It was the Village Gate.
The Village Gate. So they give us the Village Gate. Okay, not an insignificant space.
No,
it's probably seated 250 people.
The owner of which my mom used to know, oddly enough.
Nice.
So that's a little connection, oddly enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Major venue space.
Major old jazz venue space in the Village. And
exactly.
And,
exactly.
It was huge when we were there. It was huge.
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 Yeah. Huge. Huge, like reputation-wise, and huge as a giant cavernous space.
Physically,
physically
huge. Yes,
I'd never played in a big space like that. It felt like a coliseum.
Yeah,
it felt
totally.
Like,
totally.
You know, Nirvana in Brazil.
Totally,
you know,
totally.
It's just like, and so we did it there, and then we did it at some motherfucking theater space for Nymph, because we did the Fringe first.
Yeah,
and then
something
Nymph.
On Theater Row. Or I think.
Yeah, and it was a real downstep. I remember it was like, it was a nice space, but it was really like theatery.
Yeah, so it was
really,
more black boxy than.
Village
Gate was like a concert hall compared to.
Yeah, music venue, total music venue.
Yes, and that's what it needed.
And so, that's right. And you know, the cast, we took a long time casting that play.
Yeah.
We landed some really We got really lucky.
Yeah.
Joe Pendelsky and April Vidal in the lead roles.
Yeah.
You know, we even had like, you know, Timothy Reynolds and Bob Lane and Hank Wagner and John McConnell. In like not even major roles. Like, you know, I mean, they, you know, it was big.
And,
there's choral moments
and
a musical.
But like killing said, it. Absolutely
right,
killing
said,
their individual.
We had talent from the top to the bottom.
Kathy McNellis.
Kathy McNellis as Lucy.
Yeah,
That's right.
Yeah, across the board. No small roles.
No. And it was a major musical in the sense of like everybody was singing.
Yeah.
Dan Rankin and Annie Bruno as the, just, you know, and Annie Bruno is like an incredible singer. Like everybody was just an incredible, everybody was singing.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was amazing. I don't know what else to say. I mean, I do know that like, you know, when we did that show in Nymph, this big Broadway producer, I can't remember his name. He's dead now.
Yeah.
You know, called me up and was like, you know, we need to go to dinner and we need to talk about this thing, you know, moving. And so I went to dinner and it took him about 10 minutes to make it clear that really what he wanted to do was bang me.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was one of the only times I've actually ever been like sexually
propositioned.
I don't know what's harassed in the theater world, you know.
Yeah,
like I always wanted to be sexually harassed,
right.
But and so it just, you know, it, but that, you know, the thing is like the show is filthy. It's the filthiest thing probably ever written. I mean, I think
because
it borders on, you know, it's very, it's got that South Park, You're in Town mix where it's kind of, you know, saying incendiary things, but then it's, you know, it's about porn and dirty politics and criminality and, New York City.
Right.
And, you know, I actually loved New York at the time, but it was just kind of like a New York City as like a sewer land. But you know, to have a show where, you know, you've got someone, you know, you've got this weird lesbian suffocating a man with the smell of her vagina by sitting on his face and killing him. Then you've got the star Polly singing her great aria on the toilet. And then you've got the culmination is where the homeless guy and the B-level porn star are told that they'll have fame forever if they just climb onto the electric chair and have sex while being electrocuted to death. And that's the great...
Save the world in the process.
Save the world.
Yeah.
And that's the great catharsis of the show. It just went from one kind of, you know, despicable spectacle after another.
Yeah.
But the great thing is, he said, that despicable spectacle was like laced together with your music, which is so melodic and like gorgeous.
Yeah.
And like, So what I really liked about the show was like the dissonance, like the contrast, where you're writing like, you know, like, I'm sorry, like Barry Manilow, like level melodies that...
Sure.
Yeah, that just make you, that just make, they're just so uplifting and melodic but yet the language in them is just so fucking weird.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, like what, that's kind of what I remember about the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything
more you want to say about it?
Well, no, I mean, to your earlier point about whatever I was doing or have done with you and your lyrics, you know, a large part of me feels like that's the job. Like I'm appreciative of the liking it, especially of you liking it, which was the only person that really mattered in terms of liking it and moving forward. But I mean, yeah, that's the job. Like to not follow the text, to not serve the character in that very moment and in the scope of the play is just not doing your job. So the threshold for me it may be different from others in that sense. But yeah, that's the job. But so as far as the contrast goes, not deliberately, but in response to the play and what you were just saying about it. I mean, if those other shows were irreverent, this is irreverent times 10, like the same comparison of Shakespeare on mushrooms. This is irreverence on cocaine. And
right.
You know, right. Like yeah. an OD of cocaine. Cause it just wouldn't stop. It was just gross and then more gross. And then really you're grossed out. Here you go. More.
Yeah.
And what's coming up next, you're really not going to want it.
In fact, I'm reminded this couple came and saw Darwin, and he was like an evolutionary scientist from NYU, and his wife, and they just loved Darwin. And they just wouldn't shut up about Darwin. And I ran into them, they came and saw Banger's Flopper, which is the thing we did right after Darwin.
Right.
And I ran into them like a year later, like in an elevator somewhere. It was terrible. I walk into an elevator, and there they are. And we've got like, it's Manhattan, so we've got like 90 floors to go. And I go, oh, hey, Bob and Susie, wow. Like, oh, yeah, like, you know, you saw Banger's Flopper. Yeah. Well, what'd you think? This old man looked at me and goes, we hate it.
Oh my God.
Remember I was like, oh yeah, you know, we just kind of went in a different direction, you know. And that was a quintessential moment for me where I realized that it was often hard for me to, like, Inverse always had this thing, like, we got to build audience. We got to get their email address.
Yeah.
We got to make sure they come to the next show.
Yeah.
We got to get a subscription model. So they'll, you know, the thing with Steppenwolf was all, you know, Jenny Hennigan, one of our actresses, ended up working with Steppenwolf. And she said, Kirk, they sell out their whole season before they've even announced it. So it was always, you know, there was this energy of like, we got to be like that.
Right.
And when that guy looked at me and said, we hated it, I realized, you know, as much as I can be in a theater company and try to be an organization and try to be professional and try to build audience, I'm just always heading out into left field with the next stupid, crazy thing that's as opposite to what I just did the prior time.
Yeah.
That loyalty, getting people to come again and again like that is just, it's really hard. Like if you were to look at Lost Labor's Loved and, you know, Banger's Flopra and Darwin, and, you know, everybody's always just like, well, why aren't you doing that again? And so, you know, that was something that Banger's Flopra, I think, to me, really banged over the head for us, because it was just a totally weird thing, different thing than what, you know.
It's also not your style as a person and as an artist to either repeat yourself or to do what other people are telling you to do, which usually garners the opposite. Rightfully so, the response. Like, really? You're dying for me to do that thing? I'm sorry to disappoint you in advance, but I won't be doing that, and I'm going to see how far in the other direction I can go.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure that's a good personality trait. Well, we can talk about that later.
Maybe as a person, but as an artist, I think pretty cool.
Well, we'll see. That's another thing. So
let me just interject to say that on our first official meeting after I accepted your proposal, I said to you, we were in that joint, we were getting a burger at that place that's, I think, not there, on like 2nd and 2nd or something, or it was near 7A. They had a little music thing in the back. And anyway, I'll think of it. And I said to you, you were like, well, what do you think? You want to, you know. And I said to you at the time, I'm not the biggest fan of verse, and wasn't at the time. I said, but I'm a fan of you doing that. So I'm a fan of you, really. I dig the fact that you're doing that. It takes balls to do that. So from a purely artistic standpoint, I thought how much fun that would be to work with someone not only writing in verse, but who has the balls to do that. And so it's going to be interesting no matter what. And I had already written, I had already gotten a sample of your lyrics from Darwin. Yeah. And they were just fantastic. And that was like a peanut compared to the tree that Bangers was. But how could I say no?
Yeah. Well, that's, I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a fan of verse either. There's only two people who can write it. as T.S. Eliot said, you got to, you know, T.S. Eliot tried, he wrote five verse plays
and he gave up
and he said, you know what? You have to spend your whole, that's so hard to get that right.
Yeah.
You have to spend your whole life doing it.
Yeah.
And, because if you don't spend your whole life, you end up, it just doesn't work.
Well,
so
yeah,
anyhow,
that makes sense.
And that's another topic too. But how to do it? You know, that's an interesting.
You could do it and
how
maybe
to do it
not
well.
Do it well or in a way that affects people or reaches out. It's a monumental.
I've always felt the problem with verse is that as soon as people start doing it, they get pretty stiff and they get pretty serious. And stiff and serious in general aren't the best things to bring into the theater.
Correct.
If you're going to be stiff and serious, then make stiff and serious characters.
Yeah.
And proceed to make a lot of fun of them. Or at least, you know, that stiffness and that seriousness needs to be involved in the drama at the level of conflict, at the level of discussion, not an overarching ideology. Now that would be me with Stoppard. That would be my thing with Stoppard.
Okay.
It's like, there's stiff and serious. It's a little stiff and serious for me. It's not, and by the way, it's not verse. It's like philosophical theater.
I agree.
It's philosophical theater, which is cool. It's philosophical theater, but that's when I say only two people really write verse really well. What I mean is only two people bring, you know, use the verse as a almost a transparent medium through which to engage all the character traits of humanity without the verse having its own agenda, its own ideology. The verse serves the dramatic energies, the dramatic choices. It's a musical way to present language.
Yeah.
That's really all it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you know, it's a musical.
Absolutely.
It's rhythm and rhyme. It's just rhythm
and
rhyme.
The trick for me, which also applies to music, is for it not to sound like verse, which is a gift of all the actors that, as far as I know, have ever recited your words, but also in the writing itself, there are so many words that you could choose, and the ones that you end up choosing just make it flow in a way that is absolutely musical. And so nobody's sitting there going, "Oh, this is in verse. How cool!" It's just so
right.
It's so. Meaning, there are so many other aspects to the play itself and to the writing of it that make it like Lost Labor's Loved. I mean, I didn't. I may have thought about it once during that whole thing. It grabs you by the throat, the characters, the actors, the whole thing. It's not, if you're focusing on the fact that it's verse, you're not there to see theater, you know, or
right.
So I think that is it's almost just, it's like a vehicle that you could easily fuck up because there are all these other aspects.
And you know, that somehow reminds me of the issue of like the theater is where rock goes to die.
Right.
And, you know, mentioning the rising fall under the fallen rising Hedwig, you know, and then the Bangers, you know, it's like you're dealing like rock and roll is nighttime street music, you know, it's music.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the music of CBGBs.
Yeah.
It's the music of
drugs. It's the music of booze. It's the music of sex. It's sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Absolutely.
And the reason Hedwig works is that it's like, it's a punk show. It's like just a punk show. And the guy's like gets his dick cut off, and he's fucking running around in Germany and getting all, you know, so there's like, so it's almost, you know, it's almost like, it's like the, it's got the rock and roll thing of like in a van and you're eating road food and you're, you know, it's down and out, it's gritty. It's, and obviously Rising Fallen is like on an oil rig and our play is like in the gutter and it's thieves and crooks. And, you know, if you try to take rock and roll and serve any other kind of vibe or story or socioeconomic situation, then the rock and roll is gone, because rock and roll is is Motley Crue at 2 a.m, you know. Anyhow, let me ask you this. So, and I'm realizing now, you know, and I don't know if I've ever said this to you, but I'm going to ask you what we did next, but I want to say that through conversations with other people, I've realized that right about this time, Bangers Flopra, and then what came after, up until like 2012, when I shut my gate, started drinking, and quit theater. Yeah. From Bangers Flopra to that day in 2012, I entered a dark phase. I'd done these Shakespeare things that everybody thought were all wow, and then I'd done the American Revolution and Midnight Brainwash and Darwin, all very, you know, I don't know, theatrically jouissant, playful.
Yeah.
Spectacle.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
And they, you know,
much,
they have characters,
much lighter,
and they have,
funny, and
broad characters and plots, and you know, and their goal was to be liked.
Yes.
I wanted to be liked.
Yeah.
Their goal was to like make theater. And after Bangers Flopra, see, around that time, I was like, you know, I'm not a commercial playwright.
Yeah.
And I'm not an avant-garde playwright because I keep writing plots and characters. Like, I think I'm a literary playwright. That was the phrase I gave myself. Mm-hmm. But I'm you know, by the time Bangers Flopper was what, 2005, 2006,
four and five.
Okay, so I'd been at it 15 years.
Yeah.
And I was still, whatever.
Yeah.
Digging for money
in
other people's pants, you know, and so I decided I kind of consciously started to decompose and decompress and deconstruct and fall apart, and in a sense, I'm not saying that's like that was a bad thing, but it's dawning on me now that you were the composer for that phase.
Oh, that's interesting. That's right.
Of my career.
That's right.
And while a lot of people, I think I alienated some of my regulars as I headed into 2005 to 2012, because they'd done these sort of different kinds of plays with me, but you, who'd never done those plays, entered my life at that. And we proceeded to do my kind of wilder, weirder avant-garde plays. And so tell me this. What came after Bangers?
What came after Bangers was $3 Bill, which was a commission.
Okay.
Not
that was a commission.
And not necessarily in the direction of what
That's
you were
right.
just talking about.
That was a commission. I tend to avoid commissions.
I know.
So
it was really fantastic. It was, interestingly, while still in verse and still very Bromleyan, it was like Darwin, very accessible and very. Darwin was also a commission, from what I remember.
That's right.
And very accessible and very, you know, as pop as you can get, meaning you.
Yeah,
you,
that's
Kirk.
Right. That's right.
And I mean, Darwin is still. That's not only my favorite play of yours text wise, but maybe top three at least, certainly. But in terms of the language, that I remember at the time thinking, to my earlier point about not noticing that it was verse, that was just some of the most beautiful language I had ever seen put together in one shot. And I remember saying to someone that I wish people spoke that way to each other. Yeah. It was just so, just so eloquent and just so,
Thank you so much. And it's interesting because I don't know if you know this, but for the last 8 years, 10 years, I've been technically like rewriting all my plays. Yeah. And preparing them for finality, which has for me come to mean audio recording, like an audiobook recording. Like I'm on the seventh one now. Right. And Darwin and $3 Bill, both commissions, are the two plays that I still can't get myself to even be in the same room with.
So I'm just like, funny,
get out of the fucking room. And you know,
I mean, they're kind of not yours if you want to get.
Exactly.
So I totally know what
you're right. I'd never realized that. They were both commissions, and I was writing for something else. But Darwin was hugely. People love that play, and I love it too.
Beautiful
and
play.
I have to figure out how to finally put the finishing touch on.
I mean, that'd be kind of cool if you left them out. I mean, that would be.
Maybe, yeah, that's right. It might be cool. You're right.
Well,
maybe they could be. Found under my bed and
right. Know, well, I mean, in that sense, if you're going to record it, I would say record Darwin exactly the way it is. Don't change one letter.
Yeah.
And that's the way
you
don't need to spend energy.
We'll see. So what was after $3 Bill?
After $3 Bill was No More Pretending, which I just...
Great. So you did music for No More Pretending?
No, just sound design, mostly.
Sound design?
Yeah, I forgot what it even was. There was some sound effects and maybe there was a song in there or some kind of like underscore, not like a sing song, but like maybe something like that.
Yeah. Maybe.
But that was, I just had fun being there. I mean, I was at rehearsals, so there must've been something enough to bring me there.
Okay. And No More Pretending literally is, In the very title, it indicates where I was.
That's
the
beginning, and that's the official next one after Bangers.
That's right.
So you're correct in the trajectory.
And that was where I declared, you know, kind of I was done with suspension of disbelief. I was done with character. I was done with plot. I was done. I'm joining the ranks of the avant-garde because they're getting all the grant money.
Yeah.
They're getting all the attention. And I want to be an avant-garde playwright. Yeah. So I did No More Pretending, but you're right. I think it was light underscoring for that. So what came next? Because I think, you know, I think it's worth saying that after Banger Slap, I was like, I want to make more songs with Gideon.
Yeah.
But, you know, it takes so long to do a play. I'd probably already written $3 Bill and No More Pretending by the time Banger's Flopra was like done. And so really for me...
Yeah.
The play that I did after No More Pretending, I think is the one where I facilitated another collaboration, in-depth collaboration between you and me. Do you remember what was after No More Pretending?
That would be Me.
Exactly.
Big time.
So Me was really where I was like, you know, working with Gideon on Banger Slap was fantastic.
Yeah.
It's time to do another play with songs.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, Me was, we won some kind of thing where, or the Ohio Theater was like, okay, you're our, like, it was the Ice Factory.
Oh,
they always had one play that they gave a little money to and a little bit of publicity money. And, you know, it was like, we were the featured thing. So it was Me, we were the featured thing.
Yeah.
And And oh, by the way, so we needed a director for me, right? Yeah. So who did we choose? We chose Alec Duffy because Alec Duffy had worked with Banana Bag and Bodice,
right,
and probably directed The Rising Fall of the Falling Rising, I would imagine, because Alec Duffy directed, and you'll remember, I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. You'll remember. Okay, here's an interesting historical note.
Yeah.
We were at some high-rise apartment in Manhattan during Nymph, during Bangers Flopra, big-ass cast, might have been a cast, might have been a closing night party, way up in the sky, and standing in the kitchen was Jason Craig, Jessica Jelliff, I believe Alec Duffy, and the composer who did all the other music for the bangers for Banana Bag and Bodice, whose name escapes
Mine
me,
too.
But he is now a massive star.
Yeah,
he did the Josh Groban musical on Broadway, the Comet.
Oh,
you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, there are several titles that are escaping me, but yeah, the thing with the pianos. And
yes, well, he did two pianos, and you know who the two pianos? No, the three pianos.
And Alec Duffy was one of them, right?
Alec Duffy, this dude.
That's right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yes. He's become enormous.
Well, he's a major Broadway composer now, and he was just literally a schmuck from San Francisco, who had worked with Jason Craig in San Francisco, and that was his first night in New York City, hanging out at our cast party, and that night we met him. So we somehow circled back into that scene by hiring Alec Duffy to do me.
Yeah. We could.
Because we were always hunting for a director.
Yes. Yes. Like you said, we could go on and on about Banana Bag and Bodice, and deservedly so. I remember just being so, I was already enthralled with them as a company and as performers and as writers especially, but that fucking music, man, holy Jesus, it was just masterful.
Right.
That, it was just so, what a perfect.
Dave Malloy. Dave Malloy was his name.
Yeah.
But it goes, Dave Malloy did not write the music for The Rising Fall of the
Falling. No. That was
that was Jason.
He did the other plays that we had seen.
He did Gulag Haha. He did Beowulf.
The ontological, maybe.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's where I first met him.
Oh yeah, so, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. They did that
song.
Yeah, they did.
And then there's that one that they did in Brooklyn with the dude with the chicken dude and the
exactly
the
that
and
one
the knives and the oh my god it's just the best
yeah it was Panel Animal.
Oh my god,
he did the music for Panel Animal.
God. Some of the best, funniest, just
superb, oh absolutely
superb.
Absolutely.
God bless you, Jason and Jessica and all of you.
Anyway,
so we were in love with Alec Duffy.
That's right, because he was part of the Banana Bag and Bodice scene, and so we're dealing here.
Exceptional.
That's right. So we're here. We're hanging out with the Urinetown dude, like all these people getting big Broadway play. Action on Broadway, and so we grab Alec Duffy and we do this play called Me, which again it says right up front what it is a good friend of mine, Tom Sullivan, came to American Revolution in Central Park, and we went out for a drink after. And I said, Tom, I can't get a break. I don't know what the fuck. And he said, I just think people are more interested in you than they are the American Revolution. So I proceeded to write a play called Me. And
which was your point earlier about no more pretending. Like, instead of pretending to be this kind of playwright or whatever, let's just why don't I just write about
instead of pretending to be Mordecai.
Right.
That's right, myself.
I'm just writing about myself. Right, boy,
and of course, one can ask whether it's actually about me, but that's of course obviously the point. But it was definitely I thought a vehicle for your songwriting.
Oh, yeah.
And so we had There's 12 songs in there or something like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a couple more.
Like,
but
an album's
fifteen albums
worth of music.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a play with music, and it was meant to be a play with music because I wanted us to, you know, keep writing, and we did, and we did me, and it was so good. I've lost the weight of the world. I mean, that song,
Jesus.
Just,
I mean, it breaks my heart, that song.
I know.
Oh my God.
I know.
Oh my God.
I want to hear what was your experience doing me?
Yeah, Jesus. Well, the first,
which, by the way, let me say right before you talk, was not a rock musical.
No.
It was a whole new thing. So go ahead.
It was as eclectic a show in the canon of the shows that we did together as each song in Bangers was eclectic. Meaning it was its own very unique vibe, much more internal. There was half the play and then half that Chinese play, which was so beautifully interwoven. So there was a lot of this underscoring, the big drum the first thing I wanted to say was on the list of questions that I read before that you had laid out, it was like, what's your favorite Inverse memory or something like that. And the first thing that came to my mind was doing me at the Ohio. Just being at the Ohio was such it was like a cathedral. And I remember you had been speaking about it for.
Yeah, it was my dream to have a play there.
Yes, you had said just that it was your dream to be at the Ohio. And I remember hearing you say that. So that when we got it, I was already, it had already been built up in my head that this is a special place. And that got exponentially, that grew exponentially the first step I took into that place. And Bob Lyons and his beautiful way about him and so nurturing accepting. Like he was hardly there. And he's just like, sounds great. Sounds great, man. It's looking great. You know, so pure support. Anyway, so.
And he had that rainbow dude whose name I can't remember, who was kind of helping him, but who worked for Live Nation. Who was also really loving and came to all the shows. And Keanu Reeves came and saw that place,
sure
too,
did.
By the way. You remember?
Well, not only do I remember, but the fight scene. In the Chinese way, the fight scene between them, I ripped out right out of the Matrix dojo scene. And in between acts, on my way back, I stopped by and tapped him on the shoulder. He was sitting right in the end.
Oh.
And I whispered in his ear, I said, you know, I took that fight scene right out of the Matrix.
Nice.
He's like, yeah.
Nice.
That sounded familiar. I was like, yeah.
Nice.
Might have said, yeah. So that was a very,
you did that without knowing he was going to come to the play.
Oh yeah.
No, of course it was a total surprise.
Absolutely.
So yeah.
So,
tell us about me, making the music.
So I actually remember you calling me and Timothy and Hank and maybe Bob out to lunch one day. I don't know if you remember this, and you didn't say anything. You just said, "I just want to meet you guys for lunch." So there was this kind of sexy mystery to that, and we sat down in some whatever little hole in the wall, and you said, "You're writing this play. You've been writing this play, and it's about you, and it's called Me," and you were. You were markedly, scared or insecure about it or unsure. And I thought that was really sweet and really, and this is coming after Bangers Flopper, the dirtiest, raunchiest, unapologetic show maybe ever written. certainly ever allowed to be produced. And and I just thought, well, son of a bitch, look at this guy. He's like the Ohio, interestingly enough. I thought, well, this is important. Whatever's going on right now is really important, and it's important to him. And I just remember being really honored, and I wanted to be super respectful of what you were asking. I mean, basically, this was your version of saying, I wrote this play, and it's a little, you know, the departure, right. And I just want to know what you guys think. And, you know,
it's kind of like
just you wanted to hear, you know, is it good or not? Or
which
is funny because no, I don't think, I don't know, at least from what you end up releasing, I don't think, I'm not sure. I'm positive that you're capable of writing not good stuff for you, meaning based on what your good stuff is. But I just find it endearing that you would ask, you know, a bunch of us, that you were in that space. And I thought, oh, this is really a tender, you know, intimate thing. And so that, I'm sure unconsciously for me, set up what the music had to be. Really respectful, really intimate, very heartfelt, very, which different than Bangers, which was a lot of contrast, a lot of, if the lyrics were raunchy, the tune was gorgeous. If the lyrics were, went in one way, the music often went in the other way, just because it would be too, would be too much. You can't have, you can't have the darkest theme and lyrics of the song and the darkest music. It's, you know, start hanging themselves. So, so it has to be the Three Stooges because otherwise, you
know,
and I'm just countering what you're doing. I'm not saying I'd like to write a Three Stooges song. How can we balance this out in a way that is palatable and enjoyable? And anyway, so with me, it was the opposite in the sense that you, with your decision to write such an intimate piece, were giving me permission to just play it straight. Like, this is a beautiful song. These are beautiful lyrics. There's no tongue in cheek. There's no, and that was a dream for me because that's kind of what I did before, like with my own tunes that nobody's ever heard. And, you know, and there's like 100 of them because that was just me having a feeling or a thought and an urge. And I would write a song that matched it. So I had been practicing unknowingly to write that specific musical. So that a dream in the sense that, this is absolutely my wheelhouse. If they're, you know. So it was just a pure joy. We broke out the acoustic. I got to make these really kind of somewhat anthemic kind of you know, that old Coke commercial, bum bum dee da dee dee dee. Perfect.
Yes,
it's kind of like that one, like that vibe of like communal.
I'd like to buy the world.
Yeah,
of Coke.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there were just these little short songs, which is also my favorite, like 2 minutes long, and you know, two and a half, just perfect. Where you, because you get to say everything, and you have to. It's a lesson in condensing things. So in structural ways, like taking out a bar or a beat just to keep things flowing, or there's no need to build up to anything. You have one verse and one chorus and that's it. So, and so there's a flowering that goes on that is unlike a regular, you know, pop song. So you mix that with the intimacy and the beauty of the lyrics and the gorgeous characters that you wrote, and I should also say that what we didn't say about Bangers, and which is true for all of it, is that, and this goes back to what I was saying about when you asked about working together, is that we didn't work, quote unquote, together, like I said, like Rodgers and Hammerstein, with me at piano and you leaning over the piano with the lyrics. We never spoke. We certainly didn't meet in person. You had already written the lyrics and the play, and I, it just wasn't that kind of relationship.
But that's a good point, because what the reason we didn't have to sit and, like, you know, go back and forth was that I would write these poems, basically. You would take them, and what you always did so well was, you know, you would say, oh, I'm going to repeat this line. That's going to be the chorus. Right. Or I could use an extra syllable here.
Correct.
So I'll add a syllable. Like, and so you took some liberty in terms of using the poem as a template.
Yes.
You never added words.
No. But always structural. Because if I had been in a rhythm or a certain kind of, I just needed to finish that melody. And
so when, and God willing, people hear these tunes, they'll notice at times that what's in the book, the lyrics are just a poem, but what's sung takes liberty with how often lines are sung, where they're placed. It goes back and forth. And that was just always just like, I mean, I will say this. I never once, and we have more plays to talk about. I never once, like, you would not submit your songs to me. You were like, what do you think of
these? That's what I was going to say. That's what I was going to say.
You wrote perfectly. Yeah. Everything you did was perfect. I never had a single comment about it. It was just always perfect.
Well, that's the point I wanted to make, which definitely helped with me, was that for Bangers, which again was like maybe 25 songs, the most critique I ever got from you, the biggest one was more. You know what I mean? Like more of what you're, because I would stop the song and you'd be like, what are you doing? More of that. Yeah. Keep that going and get bigger and explode. Yeah. I was like, oh, okay, cool. I guess. Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
But there was no, so we didn't work together in that old school sense. And hardly had any communication, like you were saying. I would submit them, maybe with a sense of, I think this should be the tune, and what do you think?
Right.
But, and we also ditched some versions of songs. Like, I think we didn't get into the specifics. Like, I would never have suggested a lyric change, or it was never about the text. It was always about the rhythm or the structure. And likewise, with you in relation to the music, we didn't get into specifics, and so it was either more, or you felt maybe it just wasn't landing. It wasn't kind of just I don't know. Didn't have, maybe compared to other tunes, just wasn't my best wasn't my best work, and you were right every single time. It was absolutely the right choice. And then I rewrote it a little sooner, but definitely more of something. And those were the second one was the final tune and the obvious tune.
That's awesome. Yeah. Now let me, we have like 4 minutes and the reason we have to stop is because I got this kid and his wife and all this shit. But I want to quickly read the lyrics for I've Lost the Weight of the World, because it reminds me of my, what I want to be my final question. So it goes, far be it from me to be it for me. I've lost the weight of the world. I know what I feel, like the deck knows the deal. My wave won't crest till it's curled. Act up or shut down. I can't get around. The fact slaughter starts with a smile. In all I can't face, I sense I've misplaced the wisdom of living a while. And this reminds me of, I want to know if you were privy to this thing that happened during me, because I don't know if I've talked about this in the podcast yet. My idea was that the play would end with an argument over whether we should kill a fish, cut it up, and serve it to the audience.
Right.
Because the play is very much about my sort of emotional empathy with my placenta, with having been a fetus, having lived underwater, with, you know, with vegetarianism, honestly, creatures, killing, yeah. slaughter, starting with a smile. And I remember, you know, I went and I bought a koi at a, right. at a fish store.
Right.
And transferred it in a big ass fish tank into the Ohio. And I remember we were like 4 days away from opening. Yeah. And I said to everybody, I might not have mentioned
yes,
this.
By the way.
But we're gonna I think the idea was poll the audience as to whether we should kill this fish or something. And basically everybody said, if you do that, we're quitting the production.
Yeah.
And were you a part of that
thing? I wasn't a part of the voting, but I think I was there, and I just remember absolute mutiny, instantaneous. Are you insane? Yeah. No.
Yeah, right. Giant nose. And there was a thing I had in my head at that time, that there was an artist in New York, I think in the 70s, who had put live chickens onto hot plates on a table and put glass domes over each chicken.
Oh, man.
And people came in and sat down in chairs and watched the chickens get cooked alive.
My God.
And this was like 70s performance art. And I remember, you know, I was like, that was the kind of theater I wanted to make,
wow.
you know, like let's get real here. You and I have a great connection to Let's Get Real Here later, which references back to Banana Bag when you and I were standing in front of that theater in Brooklyn after their show, and I told Jason Craig we can't go to that.
There's so much Banana Bag and Lettuce in this through line.
That's going to be next, because that's totally connected to the fish, because that was only a few plays later, and that was my continued goal to get rid of theater as a pretend fake spectacle and make it a real brutal experience.
Yeah, me was just not the show to do that with. You screwed yourself in its unbelievable beauty.
I did.
And inspiration. That was just the opposite.
Yeah.
Bangers would have been the better show to do that with. But
Yeah. Well, not every good idea can fly.
But it is. I'm just as interested in why you wanted to do that in relation to the path that you were on at the time. And what it meant to you. That's what I find interesting, whether it was done or not, is why you had that idea and what affects moving forward.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question. And that is where we will begin our next conversation. Okay. So it feels short because we started a half hour late, but life is life. We're going to schedule the next one and get together much sooner than we did this time. It was great talking to you. I sense we'll talk a little off the podcast and say what we really think, but it was great to see you. Great to talk to you. And we're going to continue this conversation very soon. So I will be in touch. My assistant will reach out to you with my schedule and we will continue this conversation beyond me.
Well said.
So thank you, Gideon.
Thank you.
So the song I'm going to close with today is called Outermost Mouthwash. And I chose it because it's the very first song on my second album, Smell the Sun, which is, of all the Good Heart albums, the one that is most influenced by Gideon. He plays on every song. I think he pretty much orchestrated the album, played tons of instruments. I mean, he produced the album by and large, I would say. It is very much his work. I recorded most of the songs at his house. So it's an album of him and me. And this first song Outermost Mouthwash. When I first heard it, it was really my first inkling into what he's able to do. He taught himself bass. He taught himself guitar. He's just like a prince, really. Multi-instrumentalist, and producer and mixer and all that. Yeah, I mean, the song is just kind of this rockin' tune about, I don't know, I guess some woman. And the little outro with the little guitar riff that occurs happened because I liked what he did with that particular section so much. I was like, wouldn't it be cool if that sort of came back as if a car was kind of like driving by with that playing on its speakers. So that's the origin of that little coda that occurs after the tune. So yeah, here it is. Outermost Mouthwash off Smell the Sun by the Good Heart.
Her heart is in the lawn, and she fucked like a fawn. I couldn't catch a net, so it hit. She woo me with a beat till I chucked up my sleeves. She never been to bed, cause she throw tea like they grow along the cliffs of sleep.
Yeah.
flame is in your brain, and she burned to
This has been the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirkwood Bromley. For more information, visit inversetheater.org.